and welcome to Just Plain Wrong, the podcast where three Mennonite librarians discuss depictions of Amish, Mennonite, and other plain groups in popular culture. I'm Tilly, your moderator for this episode, and with me are my co-hosts, Abby and Aaron. This episode, we are also pleased to be joined by Sophia Samatar, author of the excellent book, The White Mosque, which tells the story of her trip to Uzbekistan, tracing the path of a group of Mennonites who left Russia for Central Asia in search of a prophesied land where Jesus would return. Along the way, she reflects on her Somalian Mennonite heritage, the intertwining of religion and ethnicity, the nature of travel and hospitality, millenarianist movements, and also Langston Hughes, Uzbek cinema, the Martyr's Mirror, and many other delightfully interconnected topics. Sophia is the author of numerous short stories and five books, including the World Fantasy Award-winning A Stranger in Olandria and Monster Portraits, a collaboration with her brother, the artist Del Samatar. Her most recent publication is Tone, a collaboration with Kate Zambrino.
Zambrino.
On Literary Tone from Columbia University Press, and her science fiction novella, The Practice, The Horizon, and The Chain, will come out this April from Tor.com. She holds a PhD in African languages and literature from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and now lives in Harrisonburg, Virginia, where she teaches African literature, Arabic literature, and speculative fiction at James Madison University. We are very pleased to have her on.
I'm excited to be here and talk to you. And thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us. We should note that she's in person, which is a rarity for this.
We are recording
around, well, three of us are sitting around the same table.
Certainly, there is a lot to talk about in regards to the White Mosque and all the many things that connect to it. But tradition dictates now that Aaron will take you through the Amish romance title generator.
Yes, this is our Amish romance title generator for us to determine, you know, what is your Amish romance title. The hardest part, the only subjective decision you need to make, is your favorite Amish treat. I don't believe this is mentioned in the book, so.
This is amazing. There is one that's mentioned in the book, and so I'm going to have to go with shoe fly pie.
I was going to say, I guess shoe fly pie was in there. I don't know that it was mentioned as a favorite, but I like that. So shoe fly pie. So the Amish brides. And then the last digit of your phone number.
I can't remember.
Two.
Who knows their own phone number anymore, though? Right. I mean, really.
That's right. And then the first letter of your name, and you can choose whether, well, I guess your first and last name start with the same letter. But if you wanted to go middle name just for fun, you can do whatever you want.
I don't have a middle name, so it's definitely us.
All right.
Okay. Well, and murder is a pretty good word to land on, so.
No.
And then your birthday month.
October.
Oh,
interesting. All right.
So if I got everything right, what I am coming up with is the Amish Bride's Plain Murder of Love.
That is amazing. I love this.
Murder on behalf of a love.
Murder of love. Yeah.
Or murdering love itself.
I mean, maybe it was somebody else that she had to get out of the way in order to be a bride. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. This could turn dark.
This is giving me Kill Bill vibes, the vengeful bride.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You could have like something, but like the Amish version of Kill Bill or something. I don't know.
Okay. I thought we would have an opener question, which usually we try and find something tangential that we can answer about ourselves. So the White Mosque outlines a number of intriguing connections between the Mennonites of Akhmachet and notable figures who you might not expect to be linked. In particular, there's the famous actress Irene Wirth and the father of Uzbek photography, Khudaybergen Divanov.
Pretty close. I was told Khudaybergen Divanov.
Okay, yeah, that's the first thing. Khudaybergen Divanov. And since Mennonites can be hyper aware of anyone in the group who has had brushes with fame, even if they don't identify as Mennonite, I thought we should all talk about our favorite Mennonite adjacent famous person. Mm-hmm. So I can start us off. Lately, the one that I give to strangers who ask about Mennonite things is that I say that Jonathan Groff's father was a Mennonite. And Jonathan Groff was the original King George in Hamilton and has been on several TV shows, a lot of Broadway, an excellent singer. I believe he's from the Lancaster area. Mm-hmm. So I like to talk about how, you know, our, you know, brush with fame is that, you know, probably, you know, his musical talent is inherently Mennonite. You know, there's absolutely no proof of that.
That's a good one to claim. Well, and I, with Jonathan Groff, if you have a child in your life, you are also probably aware of the fact that he is the voice of Kristoff in the Frozen movie.
True. So, that is true.
Well, and I should say Kristoff and the reindeer Sven. So if you have a young person in your life, they might know Jonathan Groff that way.
He's both characters?
Well, I mean, he gives it, the character voices his reindeer. Yeah. He pretends that his reindeer can talk.
Yeah.
So, I'm not. I've seen Frozen once ages ago. No, yeah, anyway.
It's clearly a tangled tale.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it's one I literally like watched part of earlier today because I have a 3-year-old.
Erin, you want to talk about your favorite Mennonite adjacent person? Personality?
Well, I don't. Sure. I guess I don't know if they're my favorite, but I feel like I'm always looking for an excuse to bring sports into this podcast.
Fair.
Because we don't talk about it enough. So anyway, the one that came to my mind, so I'm a big Philadelphia Phillies fan, and they used to have a pitcher named Jamie Moyer, who he grew up in like Souderton, like the burbs of the Philadelphia area. And I believe like Jonathan Groff, I believe his parents were Mennonite and he may have loosely grown up Mennonite. I don't believe he is actively practicing Mennonite or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I like to throw him out as a name. And it was great when he was actually like, he played for them in the World Series and that way. So.
Well, I had to think about this for a little bit and I definitely did not know their name. I just Googled, I remembered, oh, wait, didn't Lady Gaga date a Mennonite one time?
Yes.
What? And so I Googled this. So, yes, not only did they date, but they were engaged. And he was not, I don't think he's practicing Mennonite, but Taylor Kinney went to Lancaster Mennonite School, grew up in the Lancaster area, then went to Hollywood. That's where they met. And yeah, so I think kind of a similarly like a loose connection. I don't necessarily think, nothing about it says that he's practicing Mennonite, but has some kind of Mennonite roots of some form. And yeah, dated and was engaged to Lady Gaga for 5 years before breaking it off. So
how about that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think I have to go with a writer. This is somebody who, I don't know, you may even have already talked about her book, but did you do Rachel Yoder's Night Bitch?
No, yeah, not yet.
Okay. Oh. That is a must read. And the reason that, you know, most of the ones we're talking about are like, well, they're definitely famous and they're sort of kind of Mennonite. Yeah. And Rachel is like, well, she's definitely Mennonite and she's sort of kind of famous, but she's going to be more famous because Night Bitch is being made into a movie and it's going to be starring Amy Adams.
Whoa.
So she is like, hey, on the verge of being like really famous. Yes. And she's awesome. And the book is great.
Okay. Well, now hopefully you all know a few more Mennonite adjacent people that you can brag about, even though you've never met them.
So the White Mosque and your tour of Uzbekistan follows the travels of a group of Mennonites fleeing Russia in the belief that their leader, Klaus Epp Jr., would see them to the place where Jesus was to return. So I had not heard of this story before. So would you take us briefly through their journey to Akhmetek? Akhmetek.
Yes.
And beyond.
Sure. You're also reminding me, you know, with the pronunciation of my, this is a tangent, but we'll just do it. I recorded the audiobook of the White Mosque. Oh, cool. And when I was asked to do it, I agreed to do it. And I suddenly realized, oh no. I did not write this book thinking that I was going to have to pronounce everything in it. There is German in there. There is French. There is Uzbek. There is Russian. Yeah. And Dutch. So I had a lot of people to help me. And a big thing that I did was with somebody who's in the book, as he's called Khalid in the book, and was one of our hosts in Uzbekistan, and one of the people who went on the trip with us, did, you know, by WhatsApp, like an hour long just pronunciation session with me to try and pronounce all of these names correctly. So yeah, you're just reminding me of those times, like on the, like carefully concentrating. And then I would be taking my walks and like pronouncing these words to try to get ready to do the audiobook. But so the story is, I think, absolutely fascinating. It is one that I wasn't familiar with either, which was one of the things that was weird and curious to me, because I went to a Mennonite high school. I went to a Mennonite college. Like, I had a very Mennonite education, and you would think that I would have heard of it, and that if I heard of it, it would stick with me, because it's a kind of a surprising combination, Mennonites in Central Asia. So this was in the 1880s, which was a time when Mennonites from the Mennonite colonies in Russia were leaving Russia because their special privileges that they had there were being revoked. And of course, the big one was that they didn't have to join the military. And that under those conditions, they had settled in that, and it's actually what's now Ukraine. So it was southern Russia at the time. They had, you know, settled there under those, under that agreement, and then it was being revoked. So they were leaving. And most of them came over here. They came to the US and Canada. But there was another group that believed we should not go west, we should go east. And they were led by this extremely, you know, charismatic and gifted preacher, Klaus F. Jr., who believed from his reading of the book of Daniel and Revelation that Christ would return to meet the faithful in the deserts of Central Asia on March 8, 1889. And so a number of people, actually a large number of people, joined this trek. And there were other leaders besides Klaus Epp, especially in the beginning. It was sort of like people came from different colonies in Russia, and there were kind of three different groups, and there were five wagon trains in the end that went on this two-year journey into Central Asia. But by the end of the trip, Klaus Epp had emerged as the main leader. And by the time they established the village of Akhmachet in the what was then the Khanate of Khiva, which is now the province of Khiva in Uzbekistan, by the time they got there, he was really the main leader of that village. And that village continued to exist for 50 years until the community was deported by the Bolsheviks.
Wow. Yeah. It's so fascinating. I can see why you wrote a whole book about it.
I started doing research on it, and I found that a number of the people who had been on that journey had written memoirs, which were, you know, they weren't, only one was published. Two of them were officially published. And then there were three others that were like, just written for the family, often when the people were elderly and they were remembering, you know, this journey and writing it down so that their kids would have it. But these are now held in libraries. And so I was able to, you know, kind of cobble together the story by using these different accounts from people who had lived it.
Awesome. Yeah. I don't think in my Mennonite education, which it's only been 4 years of Goshen College, but, you know, taking specifically Anabaptist history classes and even working at the historical library, I think I had seen some of the titles, you know, about Eastern treks, and had no concept of this offshoot. And I don't know if it's because the numbers are just smaller than the larger migrations, or if it's one of those things that we just aren't happy talking about. Like, we're only just now talking about Anabaptist offshoots in Munster, and that was almost 500 years ago. Mm-hmm. So
I think you're right. I think it's the latter. I think it's, you know, what the way people have talked about it with me, especially, I mean, one of the really interesting things about writing the book is that since writing it, I've been contacted by a number of descendants of these folks who, and I'm, you know, who are by and large, you know, very happy with the book and happy that it's out there and, you know, talking about what it was like to belong to families who had had this experience. And yet there was a lot of shame around it, you know, because it was the idea that they had, you know, they were wrong and they had followed sort of a false prophet. And, you know, it wasn't, I don't get the sense that it was like a story that was hushed up and swept under the carpet as mm-hmm. much as it was just like people not wanting to embarrass those families. And so mm-hmm. they just wouldn't talk about it. And the families themselves were embarrassed, but they didn't talk about it. And, you know, a couple generations of not talking about something is enough to kind of get rid of it, you know, mm-hmm. and to the point where some of these descendants are saying to me, like, I knew that my family, you know, that my whatever grandfather, great, great had been on this trip, but I had no idea what it was, why they did that, why they left, like all, you know, sometimes mm-hmm. all they knew was just that, yeah, this was us. And that was it. They didn't have any mm-hmm. kind of details about it. Mm-hmm. But I think now, well, I think, you know, in the 21st century, since they've started doing these tours, like the one that I went on, this mm-hmm. Mennonite heritage tours of Uzbekistan, there's a totally different attitude toward this trip, which is certainly the attitude that I share, which is, this is super interesting. Mm-hmm. This is kind of amazing. Mm-hmm. Here is this Mennonite village in the middle of a Muslim Khanate. Mm-hmm. Like, how did this work? There are things we can learn from this. And so there's a really, now there's a much more positive attitude mm-hmm. toward it. And I mentioned this in the book, but I did go back and find my Mennonite history textbook from high school mm-hmm. and it's in there, but it's like one sentence. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. one sentence and it's like not positive. Right. Yeah. And so that was it. Yeah. That was all we had in our mm-hmm. book. Mm-hmm.
On occasion, Mennonites are less than perfect, but we won't talk.
Yeah.
So White Mosque is subtitled a memoir, but it seems to me that, you know, that's kind of the minimum of what it is. It's also the history, it's the travelogue, it's the extended philosophical discussion on what storytelling means between generations. It's got a lot in there. It covers a lot of grounds very well, I should say. But it is definitely a shift from your other published works, which are mostly speculative fiction. And so I was interested in how this book came to be and how you felt about the writing process and how that compares to fiction.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I am very much a fiction writer. I'm very much a fantasy writer. I'm at home in the genre. I never had plans to write a memoir, ever. Mm-hmm. So this was almost a surprise, or it was very much a surprise to me. But I was just so arrested by this story and so struck by it. And of course, you know, even though I'm not a descendant of the Akhmachet Mennonites, I also felt very close to this story because my family is Mennonite on one side and Muslim on the other. So seeing this early moment of Mennonite-Muslim interaction, I was like, oh, I need to find out more about that. And then also, I have to write about that. And so the memoir part comes in where, you know, at those places where I see my own story and my own family story, a kind of mirroring in a way, or having these echoes that are also running through the Akhmachet story. The writing process was, well, I was about to say like it was so hard and it was, but that's kind of true for all my books. Like every time I write a book, it's like, not only is it like I've never written before, but I feel like no one has ever written, like no one has ever done this. Mm-hmm. How is this possible? So it's always really hard. But yeah, there were things about this one that were especially big challenges. I kind of had to wean myself away from fiction. So the mm-hmm. earliest version of this book actually starts with three chapters that are fiction. They're like, it's mm-hmm. almost like a little historical fiction moment mm-hmm. where I make a character. She's this woman mm-hmm. and she's on the track and I like tell her story. And it was like, it was a case of me really like feeling comfortable with fiction and being nervous to leave mm-hmm. it and nervous to speak in my own voice. Because, you know, as a fiction writer and even more so a fantasy writer, it's like, I'm not, you know, I don't have to be front and center. I'm supposed to kind of disappear. You're in a completely different world where I don't even exist. And so I needed to realize at some point, well, first of all, like, what do you have if you start this book with mm-hmm. fiction? You have three chapters of fiction. A reader, an unsuspecting reader, like drops in, gets attached to this character, as you would mm-hmm. expect. Like, I'm following this woman and I'm with her. And then she disappears. And there's all these chapters on like martyrdom and likes and views and photography. And you know, as a reader, you would be like, why is she doing this? And what happened? Mm-hmm. And where's that lady who was like my friend? She never comes back. She never comes back. Like, she's gone for the rest of the book. So that clearly was not going to be a pleasurable reading experience. It was going to be very disappointing. And eventually I realized I needed to let that go. And what I did, because I had used, you know, all of these memoirs I was reading of people who had been on the track, mm-hmm. I was using those in order to create this fiction. Mm-hmm. So then I just took away the fiction, but I kept all the details that I was using from those memoirs. And instead of fictionalizing it, I quoted them. So I just have those people who wrote their own memories down, speak in their own voice about what happened. And in the end, I realized, like, well, this is much more powerful than me making something up. This is a story that is, you know, I couldn't have made it up. I don't have to make anything up. Like, it is wild. It is fascinating enough. And I actually think that, you know, in addition to the sort of, you know, echoes of my own sort of experience that I noted in the story, there's also something very appealing to a speculative fiction writer in this story, mm-hmm. because it's like, what? Like, this is like something that really happened, but it mm-hmm. has an almost, you know, it has an almost fantastical feel to it, especially the idea of people, you know, just going, just setting off like with mm-hmm. like all the kids and everything into this place with no idea of anything except, you know, their reading of the Bible and actually this religious novel, Das Heimweh, mm-hmm. which is translated as homeache, which is, you know, it's a religious novel. It's kind of like a German Pilgrim's Progress. It's essentially a speculative fiction that was mm-hmm. part of their inspiration as well. So I think there are, you know, there are reasons that a fantasy writer would get excited about this story. But yeah, it was, I needed to learn like what a memoir is, how you might go about doing that, and especially just to kind of have the gumption to use my own voice and not need to almost hide behind a character. Hmm.
Well, I think one of the things I liked so much about that is it in some ways the memoir, this is not quite a perfect metaphor by any means, but it's not fiction and it's also not a history. You brought so much of like the best of both worlds. Like mm-hmm. you brought so much history in, but you also brought your own, like these little, you know, weaving these different memoirs in and then bringing in your own voice as like, you know, you are you, but there's like a character guiding the reader through mm-hmm. these events in a way that you don't have when you're reading a history or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I just really enjoyed the blending of that. And that, anyways, I think that's just part of, so I'm really glad you chose the path you did, even if it was hard to get there. I just, yeah, I liked that, the way you found to tell this story.
Thank you. Well, I definitely wanted it to sort of still feel like a novel mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. the novel is my home and it is what I like to read. And it was in my mind while I was writing, like, how can a memoir feel like a novel? Like mm-hmm. what kind of storytelling, how can you do storytelling in a way that, yes, it's embedded in your life. It springs out of your life, but it has that kind of, you know, it feels like a novel. It feels like storytelling. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved those moments when like the people you were quoting, so the past sort of intersected with what you were experiencing in that moment. And like the one that jumped to mind when you were sharing your response was when I think it was Elizabeth Unruh was talking about like the large dragon or something like that. And you had been asking like, what could she be talking about? What could she be talking about? And then later in the book, you're like, this is it. This is this giant salamander. This must have been what she was referring to. Yeah, I really loved those little moments of connection.
Thank you. And that was part of it was part of what was so amazing about this trip was that I had been researching this story and reading these memoirs for 3 years before I went on that trip. So by the time I went, like I had all these questions. Like I had looked up, you know, Elizabeth Unruh Schultz talks about these screaming salamanders. And I was like, what? And I had, you know, I was Googling, I was not finding the screaming salamander. And so, yeah, I had come with these questions. And it was great to be on that trip with experts, with an expert Mennonite historian, and also an expert Uzbek historian, and people who really know this specific story of the Akhmachet Mennonite so well that I could, yeah, get some questions answered.
This is not actually the next question, but can I ask who Frank was? Like, what was his last name?
He is John Sharp.
Okay. Oh, okay. I know John.
And I know
he's my cousin, of course.
Yeah. Oh, of course he is. He's my too. Wait. Okay. Wait. Oh. Okay.
Are we really
going to have to figure that out? But I know that he would be fine with me saying that. So it's conventional in the US because we are a litigious people. Mm-hmm. Even if, you know, when I say we, that's the US we, not the Mennonite we, maybe not particularly litigious, but as a culture we are, a wider culture we are. And so it's conventional to change all the names in a memoir in this country, which is not true everywhere, but that's how we do it. But I know that John is very happy to be identified because we did an event together on Zoom where he interviewed me, and it was actually with Tour Imagination, like the people who do this tour, and they were taking another tour. So it was like a kind of information session. And the first question he asked, he's like, so Sophia, who is Frank? I was like, so I know he would have no problem with being identified with that character.
So like Tilly said, your book is more than a memoir, but it is doing a lot of reflecting on your experience as a Mennonite. So what questions and themes related to your Mennonite life did you feel were most important and powerful to explore in this book?
Yeah, thank you. Well, for me, a really big one was missionaries, because that's how my parents met. My mother went to Somalia with Mennonite missions and taught English there for 7 years. And that's where she met my dad. So my personal origin story is a missionary story. So that was one that I definitely wanted to explore. And then the martyrs. Martyr's Mirror was another really big one. And that was one that, you know, it wasn't, especially in earlier versions of the book, like the first version that starts with this fiction thing. In fact, the martyrs came pretty early in that first version. And so that was also, I don't know what I was thinking. It was a very experimental text at that point. It was like, it's fiction. Now it's about the Martyr's Mirror. But I knew that I wanted it to be in there, even if it's, you know, even if I had to work a little bit to really draw the connections to make it clear how I was connecting it to my own story and the story of the Akhmachet Mennonites, because one of the things I write about in the book is writing and Mennonite writing. What does it mean to be a Mennonite writer? And there is a sense in which, and I quote, I think it was Irvin Beck who said this, that the Martyr's Mirror stands is kind of like the root of Mennonite writing and visual art. And so in addition to, you know, the power of and the lasting kind of influence of those martyr stories, I was also interested in Martyr's Mirror itself as a document and as a book and as like kind of almost like if missionaries are my ethnic or biological origin story, then is there a sense in which Martyr's Mirror, even though I never read it before writing this book, is there a sense in which that is sort of my origin story as an artist and a writer?
We should probably talk more about martyrdom than most podcasts, given the subject matter we cover. And so, like you kind of said there, a lot of the things that you mentioned kind of dealt with some of the topics we've wrestled with when discussing early Anabaptist experience in the context of the 21st century, very much, you know, not persecuted Mennonites now. So anyways, and specifically, it means you kind of already talked some about that in your the section on martyrs, but your comments specifically on martyrology as comfort food. That was an interesting phrase. So just wondering if you wanted to expand on that.
Yeah, well, that's just, that was just an observation of mine during a moment when, and a moment I describe in the book when, and at this time I was a grad student in Madison, Wisconsin, and went to Madison Mennonite Church. And we had a retreat. We went to the campsite, you know, and it's all cozy and we're like toasting marshmallows. And then we had this game where you pick martyr stories out of a hat and you're in groups. And then you have to, it's like martyr charades kind of, and you have to act it out. You have to act it out with, and you can't talk. And then everybody guesses like which martyr you are. And it was like, it was a party game, you know, and it was fun. And like the kids were all playing and our group had like the kids, you know, somebody was being burned at the stake and the kids were kneeling around in a circle with their waving their hands in the air because they were the flames, like the little kids with, and everybody's giggling. And I was like, this is so macabre. Like, this is just, if somebody would suddenly come in here with like cameras and was going to put us on TV, like we would be like a terrifying reality TV show. And everyone would be like, what are they doing to the children? How can this be permitted? You know? And yet it was like, it was cozy. Like the vibe was cozy. Mm-hmm. And that is fascinating to me, how something, when it becomes part of your sort of tribal mythology and your personal story, it gives you that feeling of like cozy togetherness, even if it is the most horrific, you know, kind of like the thing itself is just horrifying.
Well, if I can follow up briefly, one thing I also kind of with in that same vein that I really enjoyed from the book that you talked about was kind of then taking that particular perspective and then comparing it to like more modern day, like you mentioned, I think, is it John D. Roth's project of, what is it called? Believing?
I think it's the Bearing Witness
Stories. Yes. And that whole idea of like, you know, or even just now when I was saying like, oh, Mennonites aren't persecuted. Well, I meant, you know, like North American Mennonites. I didn't mean global Anabaptists, which is a different story. And so I remember you bringing that in and doing some really insightful, like, in some ways, kind of connecting, but also pushing back at some of those connections, which I found really fascinating.
Yeah, it's those things where, I mean, it's a project that I, you know, on the one hand, I'm like, this is so necessary. Like, this absolutely has to happen. There has to be a kind of acknowledgement that, you know, the persecution of Anabaptists is not over. And that the stories of persecution that are happening now are as valid and as worthy of memorial as, you know, things that happened hundreds of years ago. But then the flip side of that is that it does sort of posit the martyr story as like, it, you know, it makes it even more like this is the defining story.
Yeah.
And so by then expanding through space and time into modern era and all over the globe, it's like there's a sense in which it could have the effect of making the martyr stories even more central and making those European martyr stories more central as being the first and original ones. So it's weird. Yeah. It's like I think it definitely needs to be told, but I also think that there's possibly, you know, some effects that we might want to avoid as well in terms of how we frame what it means, you know, to be an Anabaptist.
One thing that just popped in my head when you were relaying the story of the martyr charades is the game that I played with some of my peers from church, I was too indoorsy to ever be interested in camp. But I had friends who came back and told me about this great game called Persecution, which, as far as I can tell, is just
Aaron seems to know
capture the flag in the dark, or like tag. You just tag people and then you go to a jail and then you can get broken out of jail. It's supposed to mimic experience of early Anabaptists, I guess.
I think when we played it, it was just general like Christian persecution. It wasn't necessarily linked to the martyrs, but yes, that is a game played at church camp.
It could be that it was just general Christian persecution. In my head, I always mapped it onto early Anabaptist stuff. And I remember even as a kid thinking like, are you supposed to understand their fear? Are you supposed to, like, what is the value of this game? And I wonder that now too. I mean, like, the value of any game is to, you know, have fun and run around in the woods at night and have good camp experiences. But also, like, you know, I've seen people claim that they're being persecuted who, by no standards of the past, can we claim that they're being persecuted? You know, like, they are not being drowned or exiled. You know, maybe someone has responded to them on Twitter. You know, like, this persecution is not the same. And so I'm leery of, like, opening the door to say, like, we receive this legacy of persecution and martyrdom. And that, you know, validates everything we think. Mm-hmm. And we must, because our ancestors were righteous, we must be righteous. And then the flip side of that is, as I was reading The White Mosque, is that the trek to their promised land, to Akhmachet, it reads a lot like what you would think a martyrology should, that and the Oregon Trail. Where it's like people are dying left and right of horrible causes. People are being beaten and people are being killed. And there it is en route to a place that they are going because of religious conviction. But we don't think about them as martyrs because they were wrong. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, at what point do you say we value you because you had the faith to act on your convictions? And at what point do we not honor the strength that that takes just because it turns out you put your faith in the wrong person? Or, you know, like, I don't know. It makes me wonder if we should have like a disgraced martyrs book or something.
Interesting.
Yeah. This is shifting gears a bit. So one of the themes of your book is pilgrimage. And this is slightly a little tangent I'm just going to throw in, but I loved your, it sort of was only in the first part of the book, but you talked about yourself as a magpie, and that resonated to me as someone who has, I also move every 3 years. And when we moved to Oregon, some of my family joked, oh, they'll move back soon. They can't stay put for more than a few years. So anyway, just pilgrimage, magpie, all of that really resonated to me individually. But anyway, it's a frequent topic throughout the book with varied definitions presented. So pilgrimage as a journey taken with others, but that offers personal closure. Pilgrimages take time and deliberation, but modern travel makes it hard to reflect, etc. At the end of the book, you conclude that the pilgrimage you were on did not result in an I am moment, but rather in a they were moment. So if you want to reflect on that, and I'm also sort of just curious, yeah, so can you share with us your pilgrimage through pilgrimage? And then thinking about the Mennonite experience, are there pilgrimages, metaphorical or literal, that you think Mennonites should be embarking on?
This is an interesting one. So, you know, the title is The White Mosque. And as you mentioned earlier, it says The White Mosque, a memoir. And actually, there was a moment early on where I wanted to call it The White Mosque, a pilgrimage. Like when the publisher was like, well, we have to put something on there so people know what it is. You know, they often put like a novel or, you know, a memoir. And I wanted to call it a pilgrimage. And they were like, We'd rather you call it a memoir because it's more recognizable. And then later I realized that that really is better. It is better to call it a memoir. Why? Because, you know, that I'm turning around the idea of pilgrimage in the book. I do describe my journey as a pilgrimage because it shares those elements of like, there's a particular path that we go on. There's a particular goal at the end, which is the village of Akhmachet. And so it is a journey with a known shape. And it also has this association with repetition, right? Because a pilgrimage is like something that many people do. It's not just a trip that you took. It's something that, you know, is repeated through time. And there have been many of these Mennonite heritage tours of Uzbekistan, and I'm sure there will continue to be. But the other thing about a pilgrimage is that it's not random. Like by definition, it is very goal oriented and it has one specific goal. And that is in conflict with what I talk about in the book as the magpie condition that you just mentioned, Erin, which is where, you know, you're constantly like, oh, but what's that over there? What's that over there? You know, the magpie is not going to, you know, fly in that straight direct line, but will constantly be jumping off the path to search, you know, to look and see and discover other things. And through the course of writing the book, that tendency, which in the beginning of the book I saw as kind of a problem, like, wow, I can't, you know, get it together. I can't like really, you know, pay attention to one thing or like keep my mind on the task at hand. And I saw this as kind of, yeah, maybe a weakness or something that is not great, but I came to really appreciate it because it is by going off the path that you discover newness and that you also discover alternative paths. And there's something about, you know, the pilgrimage as like the one like road that you take and you get to the particular goal that also is, you know, it's a similar structure to like very, very dominant stories. Mm-hmm. And those stories always need to be, you know, renewed and they always need to be broken up a little bit. Like they're too heavy. I mean, mm-hmm. one of the ones that I'm pushing back against in the book is the story of like, you know, the Mennonites like brought all these great things to, you know, these people in Central Asia and they had really awesome wheat and they had like, they were always on time and like, they were such a great example to the, you know, and it's like, that is such a like massive, heavy, and to me, harmful story. Mm-hmm. Like we need to be magpies in relation to that, who are not only skittering away and flying away from it, but are actually like getting in there with our beaks and like tearing it apart and pulling it to ribbons. Mm-hmm. And maybe we can pull the pieces apart and make something else out of it. You know, maybe we make a nest out of it or something. Yeah. So there was a sense in which by the end of the book, I felt like, I'm not even sure that I would want to call this book a pilgrimage. If it is one, it is like the most fractured, like, you know, counterintuitive, chaotic pilgrimage that you could have. And yeah, that just to respond to the other part where you mentioned, you know, was it my I am event? No, it was a they were event. That was, you know, when people ask me about like, what's your takeaway or what did you kind of get after writing this whole book? And one of the things I answer with is that, you know, I started the book feeling like just such a strange person, feeling like an outsider, feeling like somebody nobody could understand, like always making people's heads spin with my family story, like what? Somali and Mennonite, you know, this is so confusing and how can this work? And by the end of the book, I was like, yeah, but everybody else is really weird too. I mean, really, there's no like monolithic experience. And mm-hmm. I do know why. It's because, you know, of having grown up being singled out as being particularly strange, even to the point of having people ask me like, what are you? Which they don't say so much anymore, but as a kid, like, what are you? It's like, what am I going to, a giraffe? I don't know. What answer are you looking for? But through that, you know, so I had this kind of extra sensitivity to like, oh, I'm so weird. But then look at these Mennonites that went to Uzbekistan. Look at their, how complicated their lives were, how many different languages entered their hearing, how many different cultures, how many, you know, disappointments and new visions of the world and having to reinvent their entire lives, you know? And I had this idea that the other people, the people who aren't mixed, the people who don't have these like complicated intercultural families, they are somehow like fine. Like they don't have problems, or they don't have outsider feelings. They don't feel, you know, that things are confusing, which of course is absolutely false. All of us have a very jumble, very chaotic experience that is full of all kinds of different influences of cultures, of languages, things we've watched, things we've read, people we've met. And so that's why, you know, what was very much a me story in the beginning, or sort of like me trying to solve, you know, searching for something, trying to solve something, trying to make this pilgrimage, just came to be much more focused on others by the end, and realizing that, yeah, I'm really weird and so are you.
I
thought that was a particularly rewarding thing. I've been thinking about travel and pilgrimage too, especially as I've been gearing up to be away from my home for 9 months, and thinking about ethics of travel and in particular hospitality and being open to other perspectives and things. And I appreciated different threads that you brought together. And I wish that that was a more common habit for people, for myself and for others, that we would walk around and we would look for the intersections rather than just trace the path as it's personally relevant to us.
Mm. Well, that segues nicely into the next question.
Okay, is that my question?
Yep.
All right. Yes, here we go. There are so many delightful threads in the core story that you are tracing, from the way that the Akhmetet, no, that's not right, Akhmetet Mennonite travels mimic the stories of the martyrs, to the connection between Langston Hughes and Uzbek cinematography. Are there any interesting tendrils that you found along your way that didn't make it into the book?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, my first impulse is to say, no, not really, just because I was very committed to putting everything in this book that I wanted to be in it. Mm-hmm. Look, I'm not going to write another book like this. And I was like, this is my memoir. This is my Mennonite book. This is it. And so anything that I really think is interesting and I'm passionate about, I'm going to put it in there. And there was a point where my agent was like, you know, maybe this is two books. Like, maybe this is like the history. And then maybe it's also a memoir. And I was like, no, it's one book. It's all one book. And we did make it work, even in a way that, you know, she was very happy with in the end. But yeah, I'm trying to think, was there anything that I left out that I wish I had put in there? I feel like if I would go back and look at my notes, I would find some things. But I am satisfied enough with what I put in it that there's nothing that leaps to mind.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's, and in some ways, that's a very satisfying answer. You were able to write the book that, yeah, you got everything in there that you wanted to.
Especially after you said 3 years of research and then the trip itself, and then how many years of writing?
Well, it was 7 years total. Right, so there were 3 years of research. Then I took the trip. Then, you know, there was an additional 4 years, which included something that I always, you know, try to do, which I think is a good practice, which is one of those years you don't look at it. Mm-hmm. You put it aside. By that time, I had already written a couple, I think two drafts. I think there were about six or seven drafts by the end. But, you know, put it aside for a year. Don't look at it. Do something else. and then pick it up again and go back to it. So yeah, it was quite a process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Seven years, almost biblical too.
Yeah.
Like a 40-day trip. Yeah. All right. Well, we have our last tonal shift is to switch to Balder Dutch, our Two Truths and a Lie game.
So Balder Dutch is basically, it's a game that we like to force our guests to play, where we take, you will get to hear three short summaries of a book. Two of them are real books that exist that if you like them enough, you can go off and purchase them. And one has been fabricated by us. So your goal in hearing these is to pick the one that doesn't actually exist.
Okay.
You might have an edge in this and that. I don't know if we've had someone with a fiction writing mm-hmm. background do this as much, but so that's the background. So we'll all, let's see, who's mm-hmm. reading first? I think Aaron is reading the first one.
Yeah. I just randomly assigned them to us. I would also Perfect. Say we would be honored if you took our fake story and wanted to make it real. If you wanted to branch into the world of Amish romance and Amish.
We would be fiction. Honored and also probably we would pity you if you were starting.
I can't wait.
All right. So I have the first summary. This is called Pennsylvania. Jedediah Troyer just wants to start a farm and build a home. But there's no good land to be found on Earth, so he signs up to travel to the distant planet of New Pennsylvania in search of a farm of his own. But space pioneering isn't easy when you're playing, and Jed wakes from hibernation to find a planet in chaos as rebel colonists seek to overthrow a despotic government. Can Jed and his fellow traveler, Don Beachy, make it to the Amish zone? Or will they be drawn into a world that is at war where nothing is what it seems?
I'm working with the secret psychic of Amish country. Until recently, Kathy Fitzpatrick's life was on track. She had just landed her first book deal, moved into a new apartment in New York City without cockroaches in it, and gotten the number of the cute guy she kept bumping into at her favorite bookstore. But all that changes when a chance encounter with a masked man awakens mysterious psychic powers in Kathy, powers that she can't control or comprehend, but that shadowy assailants will stop at nothing to acquire for themselves. While the nature of her powers is unclear, Kathy knows one thing for sure. Her dreams of a successful career and dazzling social life will have to be put on hold while she lies low in the quietest place she can think of, Amish country. While she adjusts to life as a fugitive, Kathy meets her new neighbor, Josiah, and finds herself inexplicably drawn to him. Are her powers trying to tell her something about the Amishmen? And is the high society life in New York really what she wants after all?
Wow. So one of those is real and one of them is not.
Well,
or not, yes. maybe the third one is not.
Yeah.
Okay, but one of those has to be an actual book.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Oh, wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So you're another one to contemplate. It's called Brother Frank. Dr. Chris Alexander, sociopath and technological genius, has designed an advanced cybernetic life form to use in battle. All that's needed to bring it online is a human donor to give it a heart and brain. But when the mad doctor kidnaps the dying child of a simple Amish couple in order to use his organs, the dark forces of the government come looking for their investment. Dr. Alexander and the monster escape into a different Amish community to hide among the plain folk, while Frank, the autistic 11-year-old boy trapped inside the body of the world's most deadly weapon, seeks to understand what it means to be human and Amish. But tensions arise among the plain and pacifistic yet closed-minded Amish as they begin to suspect just what kind of technological monstrosity is hiding among them. Before long, hard men who do the government's most dirty deeds will come looking for a killing machine, only to find a boy named Frank who has the power to defend a closed society from the worst of the world.
Wow. This is incredible. You're telling me two of these books are real?
Two of these books are real.
Okay, let's have the titles again. There was Pennsylvania, was it? Or New mm-hmm. Pennsylvania?
It's just called Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm.
The Secret Psychic of Amish Country.
The Secret Psychic of Amish Country.
And Brother Frank.
Brother Frank. All right. Oh, this is unbelievable. I'm between two of them. I feel like the secret psychic is real. And so I'm between Pennsylvania and Brother Frank. Brother Frank is probably more outrageous, but I'm gonna go with Pennsylvania as not real.
Oh,
how did I do?
I'm afraid you are incorrect. Pennsylvania is real, and the secret psychic of Amish country is fake. Yes,
Brother Frank.
Yeah, I guess it's supposed to be a riff on Frankenstein. Because its first title was Brother Frankenstein. It's actually the same author as Pennsylvania. Has self-published both of these.
Of course it is.
Pennsylvania was optioned for a movie, but does not seem to have gone anywhere. Doesn't particularly surprise
that me. Is amazing. Yeah.
And there's literally something there called the Amish Zone, where they're trying to get to the Amish Zone on the planet. And I believe that story is supposed to, like, because the Amish, I don't know, don't have microchips in their brain or whatever else is happening in the future, they essentially become the heroes of the day.
I picked Pennsylvania because both of the other ones had this theme of like going to hide among the Amish. And I was like, maybe that's like what all these books are about. And so the one that is not real will be the one with, but then I realized that this one also has like, they have to find the Amish zone where they can hide out. So all of them are about hiding out.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode on the White Mosque, and thanks especially to Sophia for joining us. We would love to hear your thoughts on this episode, as well as your recommendations, corrections, and other musings. Our next episode will be our Season 5 wrap-up, and just so you remember, Season 5 will be short because I will be living in Ecuador for a little while, but Abby and Aaron will be continuing on with Season 6. In the meantime, you can find us on Twitter, X, Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram at Plain Wrong Pod, or email us at plainwrongpod@gmail.com. If you'd like to help support the podcast financially, we have merch for sale at TeePublic and a Patreon that you can join. And as always, we appreciate it when people leave reviews and subscribe, as that's how other people learn we exist. This podcast exists, that we personally exist. I mean, maybe also. Thanks for tuning in.